Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. It's my pleasure to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And tonight, Monday Night Philosophy series is having a double header. This is Tuesday night. Last night we spoke about ending slavery. And tonight it's understanding evil, a slightly larger topic. And we welcome our online and our radio audiences as well. But we're going to dig deep into this. We're going to talk about some of the worst things that people do to people, and we're going to try to understand them. And we're going to try to understand them from a slightly different point of view. This is going to be a philosophical analysis of why we do what we do. And let's start with what people have said about it. Now, obviously, people have talked about evil for thousands of years. So I'm just going to use a couple of examples. First, I'll do one from current science. There's a man named Simon Baron Cohen, a researcher in England, I think, and his team, and they've been studying evil and the causes of evil for 20, 30 years, doing tests. They're psychologists. Their conclusion is that evil is caused by a lack of empathy. Lack of empathy. We'll go back to that a little later. The first thing that is a problem by that theory, and they recognize that problem, is that if you say that evil is caused by a lack of empathy, then people who have autism and other ways of looking at the world where you can't feel the emotions of other people, can't have empathy, would then be considered evil. So I look at it from a very different point of view, but he makes a distinction in his research between positive lack of empathy and negative lack of empathy. And the negative lack of empathy leads to evil. So he's made a distinction, but we'll look at it from a different point of view altogether. So that's one approach. One of the most famous arguments about evil comes from Zoroaster, a long, long time ago. Persian philosopher from at least the 6th century BC. Some people say it's even earlier than that. It's very hard to tell, of course, in the midst of prehistory, but an ancient philosopher. And he, in trying to explain why God was good, decided that evil must be a separate thing, something that is independent of God. And so he devised this concept of a fight, an eternal fight between good and evil. Now, people don't like that because, you know, then who's in charge? We don't really know. It's an eternal fight. So neither one is in charge, but there's like two teams. It's like an eternal World Series. And you really don't know which side to be on, although it's kind of funny. Most people are more confident to be on the evil side than they would be to make it onto the first team of the good side. And so there's a lot of popularity of that, but I'll go into that a little bit later too. It's interesting that this black and white version has actually influenced the Judeo-Christian tradition because, as those of you know the history of the Jews, they were brought to Babylon when Jerusalem was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. And so they were influenced by this strain of thought, which was already very popular in Babylon. And the whole idea of Satan and the fight between the angels and so on and so forth, it's pretty much borrowed from this approach, that there is a character like Satan who was co-equal with God. The book of Job kind of has that, where they're discussing what they should do with Job and why they should do it and so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of strain in that. Of course, it's not how it's actually answered in Judeo-Christian, but the elements of the stories have crept into the history. Now, Manichaeism was a heresy in early Christianity, which also influenced St. Augustine. And that is a direct borrowing from Zoroastrian thought on this black and white evil thought. And the Apocalypse, many people think, is that whole book of the Bible is definitely influenced by this eternal fight. They don't make it eternal, but they find it very dramatic that there's this big fight going on. And people find that interesting. So now, what do a lot of theologians do about that argument? They say evil really doesn't exist because, you know, if God is totally good and God created everything, then he couldn't have created evil, right? And therefore, it must not exist. Okay, now, how come it can't exist? So they use an analogy. They say that evil is like darkness. Darkness doesn't actually exist. It's just the absence of light. And you can say, of course, that the same thing is true between good and evil, that evil doesn't really exist. It's just the absence of goodness. And that's how it's argued that God did not create evil. It's an interesting try to get it off the hook, you know, get God off the hook. And I think that theologians are trying to get God off the hook most of the time when they're thinking clearly about these things. But God made the minds. If you believe the theory, then God made the minds who engage in evil. And God has made lots of different minds, and I'll go into this a little later. And he's omnipotent. He can do anything he wants. He's made a whole wide variety of them, and a large number of them don't engage in cruelty or evil at all. And therefore, why didn't he only make that kind? Then evil would never exist either. So you can't really completely absolve him, but there's a different way of absolving him. It's totally different. The Hindus have an even more radical approach to describing why evil exists, or why evil doesn't exist, I should say, and why God is good even though evil exists. It's that the whole of human life is an illusion. It's all Maya. It really doesn't exist. We're just fooling ourselves. It's like a dream. Even that doesn't explain why we have these weird dreams. You know, why do we have all those weird, cruel dreams that we have? I mean, I'm talking about the dreams themselves, not just the reality, but the dreams themselves. And I'll go into that a little bit later, too. But so there's a large number of different points of view about how evil can be dealt with. My approach is personality-based. I like to understand things based upon how we look at things. What are the patterns in our personalities? And that's the way I'm going to approach this today. Before we go there, a lot of people, when they think about the really, really evil, cruel things that have been done in human history, find it inconceivable. Inconceivable that somebody would do that. Inconceivable. Now, how many of you watched the movie The Princess Bride? Okay. In The Princess Bride, the villain Vizzini is looking behind him at the ship, and the hero is coming on his ship, and the ship is catching closer and closer up to him, and he says, "Inconceivable." And then they get up the cliff, and then the hero is climbing up the cliff on a rope, and he's moving faster than anybody else, and he looks down and he says, "Inconceivable." Then another character, Inigo Montoya, turns to Vizzini and he says, "You keep using that word. I don't think you really understand what it means." Because inconceivable means that you can never possibly conceive of it. And evil, when you say it's inconceivable, somebody is conceiving of these things and enacting them, and they're a part and parcel of human history, right? So I won't scare you by talking about all the worst things that people have done to each other, but I'm going to tell you one story, which I find revealing. The Tsarina Anna, 18th century, Russian Tsarina, in charge of Russia, absolute ruler. She had a lover who was also the prime minister. When she was about 60 or so, she found out that he was having an affair with a younger woman. And she didn't let him know that she knew, but she devised a revenge. Her revenge was interesting. First, at the next cabinet meeting, she had a nest of eggs, and she made him sit on the eggs and cackle like a chicken in order to warm them, to humiliate him, obviously. But after that, she had an ice palace built on the Neva River. It was a very cold winter. And so they built a palace, almost as big as the palaces, you know, I mean, just a huge, huge palace, totally made out of ice blocks. And she made him marry an old hag. And they had to spend there, and then they had a big wedding ceremony for them. And then they had to spend their honeymoon night in the ice palace without any other means of heat other than staying close together. Now that, it's not just, you know, I mean, this is very intentional. This is an intentional act. And what is it? It's to make that person as miserable as he could possibly be. I don't think she was thinking about the old hag, unfortunately for her. But to make that former lover as miserable as he could be. Now, what's very interesting is that people believe, this is an aside, but people believe that power corrupts, right? And that absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's very famous. Well, I don't think that's correct. It's close. It's a good generalization, but it's not actually correct. Power does not corrupt. Power reveals corruption. An absolute power reveals every little bit of corruption that you have. So if you don't want all the dirty details of all your dreams made public for everyone to see, avoid absolute power. It's really not nearly as attractive as people think. Because there's lots of people who've had it in history, or something like it, and they've mostly revealed themselves to be fairly corrupt, obviously, right, and have strange dreams. Why do they desire these things? So we do think of evil in terms of how people behave, but we really focus on our own definition of it. And what's our own definition of evil? This is from the personality point of view. We call evil whatever happens to us that we really, really, really don't want to happen to us, right? So it's not just, you know, I wanted an ice cream cone, didn't get it. It's really, really important things that are really upsetting. Anything that causes that, we consider evil. It's interesting because it's just another way that we look at the world. We look at the world as if we are the center of the universe, right? Each of us. I mean, that makes there's billions of centers of the universe, but we don't really argue about that too much with each other. We just look at it and say, this is the world, I see it that way. And that is the way we experience the world, because we each individually are the center of our own experiential universe. So we define it in terms of what happens to us. It's interesting because we don't pay attention to the why it happens to us, just what happens. And so I think we have a lot of lack of clarity in our understanding of evil because of that. So let's look at three gradations. We have unconscious gradations of evil, and it's caused by the whys, but we don't see it clearly. So the first category that I'll use is evils that are caused by unthinking acts. So nobody is involved. It's nature, basically. You know, if there's an earthquake, it's evil that some people just say it's evil. Now, of course, in ancient times, people believed that the gods were punishing them and so on. Most people don't think that anymore. Plenty, maybe I'm wrong about most, but lots of people don't think that anymore. But in any case, if things happen to us that we don't want to happen, you know, a sinkhole suddenly shows up and our whole house goes in. Anyway, people could say that's evil, but we're getting a little bit away from calling that evil, right? That's the lowest level, because people realize there's really nobody involved in that we know of. Next category is caused by callousness. And this we call a lot of things evil that's really just caused by the callous thinking of other people. People who say, I want to make $1 billion, and they don't really it doesn't really matter to them whether it hurts anybody else or even helps anybody. So as long as they get their billion, they're happy. But if they steal their billion in a way that causes $1 trillion of disaster for other people, they really don't care as long as they have their billion. They're callous. They're callous to the feelings of other people. And most people call this evil. We'll go into an analogy, a story about the Nazis. And it's very important, I think, in trying to understand that period of what was callous and what was the next category. The next category is the one that we really are most mad about, and that's cruelty. Why? Cruelty is when someone intentionally wants you to be unhappy, right? They're out to make you unhappy. Why? It makes them happy to make you unhappy. And so in their pursuit of happiness, they have decided to desire your unhappiness. This we don't like for obvious reasons, no? Well, life is enough trouble without people intentionally trying to make us unhappy, right? And we all do those little daily cruelties a lot, you know, but some of them are very minor, but some of them are very major in terms of, you know, putting people in ice palaces. That's the least of it. You know, people have done all kinds of things to torture people, et cetera, et cetera. And it may be that they have a callous motive. That is, I want information from you. But most of the time, there's also a delight in it, a delight in seeing somebody else suffer, because then it's not me suffering, it's somebody else suffering. That makes you feel a little bit better, superior. We'll talk about that in a little while. But those are the three basic gradations. So I want to talk about a difference in trying to understand this, because I want to help you move away from the normal way of thinking about this to something else. So how would you compare, having said this, I give away the answer, but how would you compare, there's a Nazi guard, a young Nazi guard, 20 years old, his first assignment is to Auschwitz, right? He's a guard, he has been raised in the Nazi youth. He thinks that the whole project is a wonderful project. And he goes there, and he doesn't like seeing the people unhappy. He doesn't like seeing the people killed. But he feels it's an absolutely necessary thing for the project. And so being callous to that, he does his duty. Now compare him to someone who lives in a village in India. And he lives in a village in India. He doesn't believe in Hinduism. And I'm not saying he's a Muslim, but, you know, he just doesn't believe in it. But all of his neighbors do, and they worship cows, and they find cows extremely important, even more treated more sacredly than human beings are, because they're Krishna's favorite. It's too bad Krishna liked cows more than human beings, but that's the way the culture has developed. So in this culture, cows are more sacred than human beings, and this guy, in order to completely make his fellow villagers unhappy because they've been mean to him or whatever his reason is, he takes a cow at 4 o'clock in the morning and he severs its head and cuts up its tail and does all kinds of other terrible things to it and leaves it in the town square for everyone to see in the morning. Okay, so how do we compare those two people? Obviously, as human beings, we immediately think the Nazi guard is much worse. But the Nazi guard is actually just callous. He actually believes in it. His ideas mislead him. Whereas the Hindu, or the non-Hindu, is completely cruel. He's intentionally trying to cause suffering. So that's a distinction I think we should make. Now, in Simon Baron Cohen's book, The Science of Evil, this researcher in England that I mentioned, he uses the example of something else that I think also makes it very clear why we draw a distinction between these things. He says that there's a story that a Nazi guard was going to hang a man. And his friend, the man's friend, was right there, and the guard knew that his friend was right there. And so instead of hanging him himself, he told the friend that the friend had to put the noose around the neck of his friend. Right? And of course, we're talking about Auschwitz or one of those camps. I don't know which one it took place in. It's supposed to be a true story, where all kinds of horrors are happening. And this hits us in our gut in a way that this is even worse than just killing, right? And why? Because it's an intentional cruelty on the friend, on both friends, to try to make them suffer even more than dying, that they have to kill their friend in front of it. People do this all the time in wars. They make parents shoot their children. They make, I don't want to go into it, but you know that all kinds of things are done in an attempt to absolutely infuriate the people before and humiliate them and before they kill them. So this is what was done. And the story is told because the friend who was going to be hanged, the friend who was supposed to do the hanging, his hands were trembling so much that he couldn't do it. So the friend who was going to be hanged kissed his friend on the hand, took the noose from him, and put it over his own head. Okay, now, I use that as an example because this is one way to frustrate cruelty, right? Because the whole point of the guard was to humiliate and infuriate and make you unhappy. And the friend just undercut his ability to do that by saying, I'm stronger than you are. I am not going to let this happen. I'm going to do it myself. Now, obviously, there's a stricture against suicide and so on and so forth, but I think that would be understood by anybody of any sense on the other side. So so that's the example I use for that. Now, Hannah Arendt, who has written about totalitarianism and Nazism and also communism, she talked about something called the banality of evil, the banality of evil. Famous line, it bothered a lot of people when she first said it. People have been arguing about it ever since. But basically what she was saying is a lot of it was done by people just doing their bureaucratic duties. They weren't really thinking about what they were doing at all. Right? And that this is what's so terrifying about it, is that you could take a bureaucracy and change it from making widgets into killing people. And basically that is what's terrifying about it, but at the same time, it is callous behavior rather than cruel behavior. And it's a great distinction between the two. She doesn't say that. But that's the distinction I make between the motives of the people that are involved and why one can be understood a little bit differently than the other one, although in general we just dismiss the whole thing and put it all into one category. Her answer to that was very interesting. She said the way to deal with this kind of banal evil is to forgive it. Forgive the people who do it. That we should just follow the divine authority on this and forgive people. So I wanted to talk about forgiving and forgetting, because that's another way of trying to deal with evil. No one has ever forgiven and forgotten anything, ever. This is an illusion on our part. There's no such thing as forgiving and forgetting. If you've forgiven somebody, you'll remember that all the time. You will never forget it, right? So no one has ever forgiven and forgotten, period, first of all. Second of all, forgiving implies that you are in a position of moral authority over the other person, right? That because they have harmed you, you have a moral right to determine whether they should be punished or not. That is, it is to say that you're God. Now, we give judges the right to punish people and to make these judgments, but that's a legal thing. Now we're talking about a moral issue. And so none of us, not being God, really has the right to forgive anybody. No one's in charge of somebody else's life that can tell them what their moral standing is. And so not only do we never forget, but we really aren't capable of being in a position. We have, in the law, we say you have no standing. You have no standing to be the judge that forgives somebody else. Okay? So you can understand why they did something. That's a totally different thing. But no one ever forgives and forgets. And not even God actually can forgive and forget. I'll explain it to you right now. So I know that billions of people believe that there's an omniscient and an omnipotent God who, when we're all dead on the last judgment day, he is going to decide who should be punished and who should be rewarded. And he will decide who should be forgiven and forget about it, and who should be punished and we won't forget. So why can't that happen? It's very simple. God is incapable of forgetting, just like we're incapable of forgetting for personal reasons. He's incapable of forgetting for another reason. He's omniscient. If he actually forgot something, he would no longer be omniscient. And therefore, he cannot forget what anybody has ever done. So he might have the moral authority to forgive, but he doesn't have the ability to forget. Now, at the same time that if he can't forget anything, he can't be omnipotent, because if he doesn't have the power to forget, he has a limit to his power. And so he can't either be omnipotent and omniscient at the same time. Now, there are many, many arguments like this about omnipotence and omniscience and these concepts, and it's very interesting that those concepts really don't add up, clearly. And this is not the time for me to talk all about that. But it's a very interesting part of how we've imagined something, but not imagined it clearly enough, and how if we clarify our concepts, what I call clear conceptual reasoning, we can actually make progress on trying to understand what the reality actually is. So I'm interested in that reality, and so let's talk about cruelty. What is the pattern in cruelty? Because that's the worst of evil. So we know there's these three kinds of evil. One is just from our misunderstanding, you know, unthinking things we call evil. That's just labeling it incorrectly, right? And then callousness we call evil. That's a one grade of it. And we know that people unthinkingly or just not paying attention to us will cause us lots of problems in life. We know that. And most people who are mature say, well, that's just the price of being one of billions of people. You can't always get your way all the time. So some things happen to us that are, you know, add-ons. Somebody wanted to do something, and it came up. They wanted to walk their dog, and they accidentally dropped their dog poop all over your yard. Well, you can deal with that. It's not that hard to deal with, you know. So that kind of manure can be dealt with fairly easily in life. But the part that really bothers us is cruelty, right? You liked that joke, didn't you? The cruelty is the part that bothers us. And what is it? Well, first of all, cruelty is a desire. It's a desire. It's not an emotion or anything like that. It's a desire. It's one of the desires that we have in our pursuit of happiness. All desires are in the pursuit of happiness. And we, in order to feel happiness when you have a desire, you need to fulfill that desire, right? You need to accomplish it. And so you need to cause the other person pain in order to succeed. So when somebody has a desire, a cruel desire that has to do with you, the easiest way you can pull the plug is to not become miserable by what they're trying to do, because this undercuts their ability to fulfill their desire. I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. But it's the easiest way to prevent cruel people from dealing with you, because if their pleasure is in seeing somebody in excessive pain, they very quickly and unconsciously most of the time start to realize it's not working with you for some reason. And most of the time it works, and so it's very rare that anybody has outsmarted people on this one. But that's the way to outsmart that desire. Now, that's a lot easier when they're trying psychological tricks on you than physical pain, because physical pain is obviously very hard to deal with, and it's also caught up in our fear of death. It's a totally different topic. But the whole idea there is, how do you thwart somebody when they want to, you know, cause you pain? And it is by not experiencing pain, if they want to make you feel bad. It's very interesting. I mentioned this a little bit last night. Empathy. Empathy is a wonderful, where we're talking, Simon Cohen was, Baron, was talking about how that empathy and lack of empathy is one of the reasons that we're cruel. But it's interesting that when we're empathetic, there are problems. When we feel other people's emotions very clearly, that also causes problems. It's not only a positive thing. And the reason is because we sometimes can't tell the difference between their emotions and our emotions, right? Some very empathetic people can't draw the line. And when they don't draw the line, they feel that that's how they feel. If you have a person, every time you talk to them, after you walk away, you say, I feel small. I feel like I'm not valuable. I feel dirty in some way. Or I feel, I don't know, I want to go take a shower, you know, that kind of thing. It's because they have gotten you to feel the emotions they want you to feel in the conversation, in the relationship that they have with you. And this is partially due, you're open to this because you're empathetic. If you're callous to everybody and their feelings, you're not going to feel any of this. But of course, you also give up friendship. You give up all kinds of wonderful things in life. So the nice line to draw is to be empathetic, but to realize these are my emotions. Those are their emotions. And I can feel their emotions without them being my emotions. Okay? That's confusing. No? Okay. So, cruelty, to go back to cruelty. Now, why are we cruel? Why did that ever get started? You know, at what point in human history did people start saying, hey, I like to be happy, and a really cool way to be happy is to make other people miserable, right? You see, how the hell did that start, you know? So you think about it, and you got to think, what's the pattern? What's the pattern here? Right? I talked a little bit about this yesterday. There's a pattern that I call the importance of being important. Right? It's very important in this world for each individual to feel that they're very important, right? And why is that true? We're each individual minds. And we know now that there are 7 billion of us on this planet, and there are quadrillions of other animal minds on this planet. And we know that we're just a tiny speck in a galaxy, that there's billions of galaxies. You know, it makes you feel small, as people say. Now, people sometimes complain, oh, all this scientific knowledge has made us feel so much smaller than we would have otherwise. But I can guarantee you that, you know, relatively speaking, the people in ancient Egypt, you know, who said, I'm just one of a million people in Egypt and Babylon, and that also is enough to make you feel small. So it probably in reality hasn't made people feel any smaller getting this information about, you know, how minuscule our planet is and the world. You know, I mean, it's enough for us to live on. You know, we don't need any more space than this. I mean, some bacteria only need our bodies to live in. That's their whole universe. They don't need any more than that either. So when we look at this, we say, okay, we're individual minds. We look at the world and we say, I don't feel important enough. I need to be important because I have a basic sense that I'm very important. You know, and almost every two-year-old, some have been beaten too many times before that, but almost every two-year-old walks into a room, and when they walk into the room, they expect everyone to turn to them and say, so good to see you, Sammy. I'm so glad you're here, John, whatever. Teresa, it's just so wonderful to see you. I call it the two-year-old syndrome. And people who don't get over that two-year-old syndrome usually either go to Hollywood or Washington. No, that you have to walk into a room and everybody go, oh, you're here. It's wonderful you're here. And why? Because it makes you feel important, right? And of course, you know, why does it end at two? Well, because a lot of people then have a baby brother or a baby sister after that, and that, you know, they become the important ones. So you begin to feel that you're not quite as the center of the universe. You're the center of the universe of your own, but you used to be the center of the universe of your parents, and not so much anymore. So everybody, of course, the whole process of maturing is to figure out that you actually aren't the center of the universe, that you're one of 7 billion people. But a lot of people never mature. You know, a lot of people don't actually get there at all, ever. There are plenty who do. That's why civilization actually operates at all. But most of the time, people do stick to this. So if that's true, then why does that lead to cruelty? It leads to cruelty because at a certain point, we kind of feel where we are in the hierarchy. And this is not just human. This is throughout the animal kingdom. You'll see the behavior everywhere. There's a pecking order. It's called the pecking order because the chickens peck on each other, you know. And you'll see it in orangutans. You'll see it everywhere you look. There's a hierarchy. In fact, there is no description of the afterlife that human beings have created or believed or were given, whatever the thing is. There's no description of the afterlife that is not extremely hierarchical. You know, there's archangels that will make you feel you're not quite bright enough because you're just normal. And actually, religions that are very successful usually say, yeah, there are those angels, but they're not human. And the human beings who get to go to heaven actually are in a superior position to the angels because you need to have that superiority. That's the hierarchy. And if you're in Hinduism, there's Brahma Loka. That's the best heaven. There's 27 different heavens, and you and you and you, you'll go to this place, but I'm going to the one right at the top. You know, and this is really just a hierarchical attitude that people have towards life in general because they want to fit in. Now, how does that apply to this? That's the importance of being important. But how does it apply to cruelty? When you are made miserable by something, you have to make everybody in your environment, in your local society, more miserable than you are so that you keep your place in the hierarchy. And I'll give you a very good example. And this is where cruelty comes from. A good example is a husband, young husband, 30 years old, never been mean to his wife, never hit her, 2 children, pretty happy with the whole situation. Is, you know, coming up as a young accountant and doing well. And a recession hits and he gets laid off. He goes home, and what does he do? He hits his wife. Why does he hit his wife? Because he's lost his place in the hierarchy. He needs to put himself into the... He'll even hit his kids sometime, even a fairly decent person. And why? Because he needs to keep himself in his hierarchy the way he feels about it, because his importance can't go down. Now, the great irony of this is that if we engage in this behavior when we're miserable, but the only way to not do that is to understand it and to stop yourself. It's so automatic that you really, unless you understand, take a step out and then say, oh, that's not what I want to do, you're going to behave this way. And usually it's not hitting. Usually it's snarky comments. Usually it's, you know, undercutting them and saying, you know, to make them feel that they're not really quite as effective as they thought they were and so on, instead of, you know, supporting the people in your group to be happier and more productive and more effective. And the reason for that is really just to keep your position in the hierarchy in your own mind unconsciously. So in doing this, we engage in behavior which is destructive to others and self-destructive as well. And it's very clear that it's not in your self-interest to do it. Is it in your self-interest to be surrounded by people who are miserable? Right? No. Everybody kind of thinks it would be better if people were around me were happy. And people do work on that. But when they feel miserable in order to keep the hierarchy, they push down. Now, it's interesting that one is more important than the other. The importance of being important trumps. I didn't use that word. The importance of being important trumps a lot of other desires. And therefore, it'll get in the way. And if you realize what will happen, you will be surrounded, if you're always doing this to other people in order to make them more miserable. The more miserable you get, the more miserable you're going to make the other people around you. If you're always doing this, you're going to surround yourself with submissive liars, telling you how wonderful you are, and probably stealing money from you when you're not looking. And that's what we've often done in life. We've often done this just to keep the hierarchy. I mean, how many kings were in that position? How many dukes and earls and how many local people? You know, the leader of the local PTA is in this position often, right? Because she's got the power and the other people around her are trying in one way or another to undercut her, to get around it, do this. You know, she said we had to do this. I don't like her. I'm going to do this. But not said to her face. To her face, she's told how wonderful she is. So this is the way. And there, we had a speaker in a couple of months ago from Berkeley called The Power Paradox was his book. The Paradox of Power, I'm sorry. And basically he was saying how stupid it is that in our society we allow people to be powerless. By allowing people to be powerless, we just set ourselves up for more or less social disasters over and over and over and over again. Now, it's interesting that in history, you'll find about the only time, not the only time, but the majority of the times when society has reached a peak of civilization, when we've been tolerant, when we've been more open, when we've had, I mean, this is our standards of today, but still we'll use them anyway, that in those productive times, people were much more tolerant and much more open and much happier. And the reason for that was because there was more confidence in what was being done. And if you're confident in your culture, you can tolerate other cultures. You can tolerate minority cultures that don't agree with you about everything, as long as they're not directly against what you're doing. If they're cruel to you, if they're murder or rape or theft, you're going to say no, no matter what, right? I think human society will always say no to those three things. To beating up, same thing. So they're minor versions of those things. But almost everything else can be put up with. You know, if 20% of the population is high on drugs all the time, we only care as long as they don't drive, right? As long as they don't do something that's going to hurt us. That's all right, you know? Even ants get drunk. I don't know if you've ever read the books on ants, but even ants, you know, they've done studies on the nurses for the ant babies, so on and so forth. You can get them to abandon their post by giving them nectar that makes them drunk. It's really quite impressive that this, habit is so universal. But in any case, that element of the importance of being important is fairly crucial to understand. So now, what can we do about it? I have a concept. If you understand the importance of being important, you can solve it. There's a solution to this importance that doesn't hurt anybody. It has three parts. The first thing is to recognize that you're an individual with free will. Now, it's interesting that as an aside here, that both the deterministic deists and the deterministic scientists don't like free will. Neither of them think that it exists. But they have a right to choose that. and we all have a right to decide and to think. There are certainly a lot of things that don't have any free will. No matter what you do to this chair, it won't, you know, you can say anything you want to it. It's not going to get up and walk out of the room and say, I don't like listening to you anymore. So we have free will. And if we recognize it and say, it's all right, we are indispensable to ourselves as a result. We're the only ones who get to make up our own minds. Now, you can give it away to somebody else, but at any time, you can take it back. Anytime. And the other element to solving it is to say, okay, so I'm indispensable to myself, but am I indispensable to anybody else? And reality says no. You're not indispensable to anybody else. And trying to be indispensable to somebody else is going too far and putting too much pressure on them. However, you can be valuable and therefore important to anybody else or any other group, any other society, any other small group, big group, anything, as long as you give more than you take, then you're valuable. Now, there are some CEOs who create $300 million in value. But if they insist on $400 million in income, you know, they're not valuable to the company. They're destructive to the company. It's all about more. And there's somebody who, you know, to go back to the Jesus thing, is somebody who can give one mite and it's, you know, important to her and important to that. That's a valuable thing. It's more, she's giving more than she's taking away. So it's all relative, but that part of it makes you a valuable member of society. And so your importance outside of your indispensability to yourself can be handled that way. The third part of the solution is very simple, to recognize that if you are an independent, indispensable to yourself free will, everybody else is too, you'll never have power over anybody else. You can manipulate people. You can make them afraid. You can manipulate their emotions and make them do things. But they can always say no. Anytime they want to, they can say no, just like any other two-year-old. No? To say no, 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 no. And that is something that we can all do. Any slave can say no. You have to take a risk when you say no that you're going to have the consequences of it. But you don't have control. You don't have power over another mind. No one has power over any other mind at all. So it's useless or delusional. And why do we do that? We do that also to be more important than the people whose minds we control, right? So all goes back to the importance of being important. So when you realize that, you say, okay, I'm going to solve that problem a different way. I don't have to pursue power over other minds. Power over things that don't have minds, great. We can manipulate it. We can make a great, wonderful civilization with the things that we make and stuff like that. But in the end, you know, it's a delusion to think that you have power over any other mind at all. And with those three solutions, you can feel very important without engaging in cruelty at all, without ever wanting anybody else to be unhappy. Right? And if you back away from that, you say, okay, great. So I call this transcending cruelty. This, you can get over the whole idea of being cruel as long as you understand it. You understand the importance of being important and how to solve it, and you understand what cruelty is. It's not in your self-interest. Making other people miserable, for whatever reason you have, is never in your self-interest. Never. Because it just makes other people around you worse off. It'd be like saying, I own this car, and it's a really good idea to smash it up. Now, I know we have had a couple rock stars that have, you know, gone out when they're drunk and shot their car up in a display of, I don't know what, or trashed their hotel rooms, that kind of thing, and then end up paying for it. So people might want to destroy things regularly, but there's really no point to that destruction. And therefore, it's just acting out and saying, I'm so important, I can even destroy things. I have so much money, I can burn a $1 million bill, psh, boom, you know, watch me on my video doing it. No. Of course, you realize it was some trick or another, a fake $1 million bill. Nobody really burns a $1 million bill. So we can look at it and we can say, yeah, there is something we can do about this, actually. Now, one of the great ironies is that in transcending cruelty, in getting over this habit, first of all, it's a habit. It's a deeply ingrained habit in the way we think. And Mark Twain said, habit is habit. It can't be flung out the window. It needs to be coaxed downstairs one at a time. Okay? And this is absolutely true. And so even if everyone in the world said, okay, I understand that. That's simple. It's really not that hard to understand. I've got how I can feel important. And I've got that cruelty is not in my self-interest. So, bingo, I'm different. No. Everyone's different habits, their different personalities are developed in the pursuit of happiness. It's what you believe really works for you. And using your mind intellectually to get out of that is wonderful. But it also, you need to take everything down the stairs one at a time. So let's just say everybody does this. Say it, everybody understands this within 100 years. It'll still be a couple of millennia before cruelty would disappear, I would think. Something like that. It's just so deeply ingrained. It's just like racism and a bunch of other things that we do. Also part of the importance of being important versus one group versus another. But if you look at that transcending cruelty and say that what can be done, you can really start to feel, you know, this is the easiest way to reform the human race. The easiest way to make people more virtuous. Because they're going to do it in their own self-interest. And actually, if you look at it, all the pressures that have been put on people for other things, like, for example, you put pressure on people to change their sexual behavior. That just frustrates them, and then they become more miserable, and when they're more miserable, they're going to be more cruel. Right? You take people and you suppress their desire to compete in sports, or you suppress their desire to compete financially with each other, and if you suppress that competition, they're going to feel more miserable and therefore more cruel. And as a matter of fact, if you tell people not to be cruel, you try to suppress their cruelty. That will make them more miserable and therefore more cruel. And so this suppression approach to reforming through what happens rather than what people think has actually been counterproductive to the amount of virtue that human beings possess. Now, let me explain what I think about virtues. If you take the human race, and it's, as I said, it's personality-based, my approach. If you say the personality of human beings is a bell curve, and it's spread out over this whole thing. So at one end, you have the psychopaths and the sociopaths, and even high-functioning sociopaths like Sherlock. So you have them all at one end. And then you have this big bulk where the bulk of humanity is, and at the far end, you have Jesus and Buddha and great scientists and great artists and so on and so forth. Now, it's very interesting when I first started doing this and trying to analyze this in my 20s. When I looked at that, and I said, you know what's very interesting about that? Is ask each of those groups on the spectrum what they think about humanity. You ask a sociopath what they think about humanity. And they say, they're too good to be true. They really don't know that it's a dog-eat-dog world. They're ridiculously easy to manipulate as a result, et cetera, et cetera. You ask somebody in the middle of the pack, what do they think of humanity? You know, everybody has a couple weaknesses, but most people are pretty good, like me, you know? They're like me, and that's pretty good. And so they have an attitude. They don't really think humanity needs to be reformed much because they don't think they need to be reformed. And so they look at it that way. And then you take the other end, and, you know, this is where all our 12-step programs come from. You know, every single one of the high-functioning members of our society, good as they are, just thought humanity was a wasteland of vice and misdirected energies, et cetera, et cetera. And something needed to be done about it. In fact, Buddha, you know, was the harshest, I thought, of all the thinkers, because he said, desire itself is the source of all suffering. You have to get rid of desire. I mean, that's just said, human life is worthless. It's just a source of suffering. You got to get rid of it. So I know that that's been modified, you know, by other people, but that's basically one of, that's why his ideas weren't popular for about 300 years. I don't know, those of you who know the history. It was just so anti-human. But then one of his followers came up with this brilliant idea of bodhisattvas, you know, people who were supposed to get enlightened, almost got there, but were so enamored with humanity that they decided not to do the goal of life. Instead, they were going to help you. So how well does that dovetail with your importance of feeling important? It dovetails directly into it, and that's why it's a successful idea. So if you look at that whole spectrum, it's important to step back and say, okay, what's the pattern throughout the whole thing? It's desire, pursuit of happiness. That's common for every mind, from the top to the bottom. And I will say, as another aside, you know, we talked about the personalities before, that God made personalities. He could make not cruel ones, right? God made, if you believe that God made all the personalities, God made Jesus and Buddha. You know, he could have made everybody as good as Jesus and Buddha if he could make them, because he's all-powerful, right? And he knew what was happening. He's omniscient. So he knew what was going to happen when he made the other ones. So that's a kind of tough argument. Now, it could be that he just, you know, wanted to make a whole bunch of people with as much moral fiber as you have. Maybe that's good enough, you know. So maybe he sliced it here in the thing. And everybody who has enough moral fiber to be here at this lecture trying to understand evil, that's good enough. You pass the test. But he's obviously made a whole lot of people who aren't with that much moral fiber there. The only thing they want to understand about evil is how to do it. So are there any here today that came for that reason? Because I'm sorry if I'm disappointing you. Okay. So that's how we can arm ourselves about cruelty. We understand it. We understand what's going on in ourselves. We understand how to get around the importance of being important by solving it very simply. And we know how to transcend cruelty by realizing it's not in our self-interest. Now, I'll mention one more thing before I finish. And that is, you know, I mentioned it'll take a couple millennium for everybody else to do this, right? So you might be done in 15 years, you know, whatever. But, you know, other people are going to be around being cruel for a couple thousand years. So just in case you get to come back, you want to be, you know, ready for these people. So there's two things that you can do. You can either disarm people who are cruel, or you can dissuade them, right? How do you disarm people who are cruel? You're charming. If you're charming to them, even cruel people want to have fun some of the time, other kinds of fun. And if you're charming around them, they can be very nice to you. Cruel people aren't cruel to everybody. And so, you know, you can see what they're up to and undercutting them in a way by not feeling bad when they try to be cruel to, and unconsciously, most of them, if they're not very alert to what they're doing, will soon stop doing that because it doesn't give them any psychic pleasure. because you're not handing over any pleasure to them. And so you can disarm them that way. If you don't succeed at disarming them, then you can dissuade them to not do it to you. You can make it uncomfortable for them in some way. So there's all kinds of ways that can be done as well. Although it's not the easiest thing in the world. I don't think you caused it. No. It's their personality and your personality. It's a game. It's like anything, any other game. There's a pitcher and there's a catcher. Your personality is going to be part of that equation. No question at all. And you can say, I'm blaming the victim, but that's not what I'm saying at all. I mean, it may sound similar, but what I'm saying is you can be smart enough to not be a victim. You can be smart enough to not be a victim. You don't have any control over the situation of how many cruel people there are going to be in this world. If you do have a solution to that, that's fine. I mean, I'd love to hear it. But with all the cruel people in the world, how are you going to deal with them? Now, some people say something else to me when I say this. They say, if you figure out how to avoid that cruel person being cruel to you, they'll be cruel to somebody else, and that's not kind to them. And I say, the happier you make the cruel person to begin with, the less cruelty they will inflict on other people.
But haven't you just frustrated their desire to be cruel?
Yes.
Are you creating further cruelty down the line?
It's possible that you, but they barely recognize it, right? Because they're saying it doesn't work with this person, and then they'll move on. They do it all the time. If you take bullies, right? Take bullies on a school yard. They pick on people who usually can't fight back, right? Not always. But usually, you take bullies in business, they usually pick on somebody. You take a bully that's a lion, it usually picks on the gazelle that's got a broken leg, right? It's the way people pick their victims, okay? And so if you feel that you're a victim, that's tough. That's very tough, way to live life. But we have, unfortunately, in our culture, said being a victim is a virtuous situation. I go back to Socrates and I say, if you have to choose between being a victimizer and a victim, choose being a victim, because it's better to be the victim of somebody than it is to be a victimizer, to be the one who causes pain in other people. That's what Socrates' conclusion was. But he didn't say, run out there and choose to be a victim. Throw yourself in front of people and let them be cruel to you, because that will make them happy, right? Because that's the other side of the same equation. If you feel that you're frustrating them by not making them happy, you could say, well, in that case, you should make them as happy as possible by allowing them to be cruel to you and to show that it works, because then they'll satisfy that desire. Whereas I think, in the education of everybody around us, that you should be, without being a teacher, letting them know what ideas, what desires work and produce real happiness for them and what don't. And most people give in. So that's one of the problems. So anyway, that's some of the ways to deal with it. And I want to take a couple of questions before we do it. So the microphone is right over there.
Do we need the microphone?
We need the microphone, because otherwise your voice doesn't get recorded. And I just walk away for a minute. So if you can pass it around.
So in listening to what you said, it seems to me, and I'm not sure if I understood this correctly, but that your belief is that we're all born with evil and that we have to learn to not exhibit that evil. Like you said, Buddha says you have to learn not to do something, and Socrates said you had to learn not to do something, and we can learn not to be evil. So I'm wondering how you think that we could also eradicate it going further in history, going the next generations, because it seems like something that we have to learn through somebody else not to exhibit the evil.
All right, well, first, I don't believe that we're born evil. So I don't accept that idea. Now, let me explain to you let me go back to the spectrum, this bell curve. So I think everybody has a personality on that bell curve, right? And my analogy for good and evil is hot and cold. So hot and cold, people say, are opposites. And people have talked about opposites. So one of the great Socratic ideas, too, that there are opposites, and the combination of opposites bouncing off of each other is what makes life the way it is. And I disagree with that part of Socratic, Platonic ideas, because I think that there's something else at work. Hot and cold has an objective characteristic and a relative characteristic. What's objective is the internal motion of an object. Okay, we have an object here. There's a certain amount of internal motion going on in it. This object happens to be exactly room temperature, right? Because all objects like this are room temperature. The amount of internal activity eventually evens out in an area, right? And so we know that from science. If we are all room temperature, this will feel exactly like we do, lukewarm. Right? It won't be hot or cold. Now, our temperature on average is 98.6 degrees, and that's what we say is hot and cold based on that. So whatever is 120 degrees is hot. Whatever is 40 degrees is cold. If it's zero, it's very cold. You know, we go all the way down to absolute zero. What is absolute zero? No internal motion in an object. That's what it is. And, of course, it can go all the way up to, you know, the inside of the sun or the inside of a Big Bang, in which case it's billions of degrees. Okay, billions of degrees looks at us at 98.6 degrees and says, you're frigid. You know, you're there's almost no internal activity in you guys. Okay, but there's some. So hot and cold, an objective reality, the internal motion of an object, and the relative perception on our part, which is what's ahead of us or what's more than us, it looks hot, and what's less than us looks cold. So good and evil. But let me answer my question. So good and evil, we each have a personality on this bell curve. How we got our personalities is another whole question. But we each have a personality on this bell curve, and where we sit is going to tell us, if we look to this direction, it looks good. If we look to this direction, it looks evil, because we're right here. If we're right here, if we're a sociopath, we look to this thing and everybody looks good, and we don't really have a lot of people. You look to sharks and say they're evil, because you can't find any humans that are worse than you are. And so it's a real function. Now, what is the equivalent for good and evil of the internal motion of an object? It is effectiveness in living life. Effectiveness in living life. Effectiveness is an ancient idea about virtue and vice, but it's effectiveness in living life. What's the inherent purpose of life? To experience happiness. So if you're effective at experiencing happiness and going after things and being effective in your life in many different ways, there's a lot of subtlety to that. It's a very broad brush. But then you're more virtuous. And the worse you are at making yourself happy, the more vice you have. And so this idea is the internal motion of the object. That's the equivalent for good and evil. So everybody is born with a certain amount of effectiveness in living life. There are cheerful people. Cheerful people are cheerful because they have confidence that they can make themselves happy. Other people are born depressed. They have no confidence that they can make themselves happy. And it's not that hard. You have to understand different things. But our personalities are there, and whether it's caused by genes or whether God created us, that's a whole other topic, right? But those are our personalities. They span a whole range. And I don't think we're inherently good or evil. I think we each have a personality, and we're going to look at the world and the ones around us and judge what's good and what's evil based upon where we stand. There's a lady right behind you. You've got the mic.
I can think of a few instances where charm 'em, don't alarm 'em doesn't quite work, like
sure.
Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo or concentration camps like Auschwitz or
right.
Children who are preyed on by pedophiles and cruel, you know, orphanage managers or, you know.
Killing, yeah.
In fact, the Massachusetts state penal psychiatrist who studied serial murderers who tortured their victims
right.
Concluded that every one of those men had been more tortured by his parents than anything he did to his victims.
Right.
So I think that there's a lot of conditional or conditioned kind of cruelty and evil.
Right.
It's pretty evil, some of the things people
right.
do to each other.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And that's why I'm saying that if you can solve the importance of being important and you can understand why cruelty isn't in your self-interest,
well,
that it will still take 1,000 years to move this out of human personality. It will still take a long time because it is a process that goes on and on that people have. I don't say, when I said about no forgiving and forgetting, I think we need to understand people and why they do things.
Well, slaves and shackles don't really have an opportunity.
No, the children don't have any opportunity.
No,
I understand that.
Anyway.
Hi. Really enjoyed the talk, so thank you. So one of the things that I'm thinking about is there might be some folks out there who are utilizing your third definition of evil who are just like, they're so aware of what they're doing. I am going to make somebody else suffer. I'm going to make them feel bad, and that's going to make me feel better.
Right.
But in my experience, a lot of the people who act that way actually feel like they're being just.
Right.
There's not a lot of awareness of their own evil. And if there's no awareness of their own evil, how could they transcend what they believe is evil?
You need to understand it. I don't know another way out of this because it's not natural. It's not natural to go for philosophy and say, I'm going to get out of this idea that I'm the center of the universe and try to understand it. This is a product of human civilization, in my opinion. I don't think any of the animals think about it. I might be wrong. Maybe the dolphins and the whales have a discussion going on about these things. But we're not aware of it. And this discussion about justice is a very interesting one. I think the idea of justice has come into human civilization and human thought because of something that goes on inside our minds, but that there is no justice in physical world. And trying to make things physically just, we have caused a lot of cruelty and a lot of pain and a lot of suffering as well. And the idea that's in our minds is that the quality of our emotions is directly related to the quality of our desires. What we desire, the quality of those desires will produce the quality. And I'll give you a good example about cruelty. When people sometimes say, well, if you just have to fulfill a desire to be happy, then any desire that you pursue will make you happy if you fulfill it. And so what difference does it make between them? And I say there's a huge difference in quality, and I can give you all the example of cruelty. There is laughter, which we know, if we hear it in the other room, we know it's a cruel laughter. If you're going in a movie theater and you hear people laughing, you can tell if it's a light joke, you can tell if it's a sexual joke, you can tell if it's a cruel joke that, you know, somebody just got hit in the balls and everybody's laughing about it, right? And you go to the theater and say, why does everybody laugh about such things? But that's cruel laughter. And that quality of the desire that's being fulfilled shows up in our voices. It shows up in our, we can all tell broadly, not you know, you can get really subtle at this too, but broadly, almost everybody can tell those differences. And so I think internally, the pattern is that the quality of our emotions, of all of our emotions, is directly related to the quality of our desires. And that this is what gives us the impression that life should be just, that balance. But that balance is something that can never be fiddled with. Nobody can get involved. No bureaucracy needs to fix that. It's immediate at all times. But we have projected out into the world that, along with all kinds of other things we project out into the world, like domes and Washington monuments and stuff like that, into the world of our civilization, of things that are going on in our own heads. And I think that there is no such thing as justice, as a lot of people say, but that we could be, but we could be wise. We could be wise in our society about how we do things rather than just. And justice, I think, is just a big hammer most of the time used in order to try to get your way. And sometimes be cruel to other people, sometimes to be good to some people and bad to others. But that idea, I would like to see disappear from society, too. It'll take a couple thousand years as well.
You said that people who are happy and confident don't need to be cruel. However, there are people who are unhappy, and they're very kind people.
That's right.
They're not cruel. So you can't really categorize.
I didn't mean it to be a one-to-one correspondence. There's a lot of subtlety to the arguments that are very hard to convey in a lecture. But in general, people tend to be more cruel the more miserable they are because they need to make the other people around them more cruel. That's just a tendency. There are some people who suffer from all the things that go on around them, but they're very kind to other people. They're never cruel to anybody else. There's some very poor people who, you know, get along really well with everybody around them and so on and so forth. It all has to do with their belief towards life and what they think should be done. There are a lot of people who believe you should suffer because if you suffer, that will make God happy. And if they believe that and they're operating, they're going to be satisfied by their suffering. Thomas More had a great argument. I mentioned this in my lecture on him. He had a great argument about this. He said, if this were actually true, then Jesus would never have said, be kind to the poor, be kind to, you know, try to make their lives better, try to help everybody make their life better, because otherwise, if to have a miserable life was the best way to be happy in heaven, then we should be out trying to make everybody miserable so that they could go to heaven, you know. And so that's not what God said. That's not what Jesus said anyway. And so there must be something else at play here. But if you are wise enough to be kind even when your circumstances are bad, then you have a pretty effective way of looking at life. That's the way I would look at it. I was raised, educated by Catholic nuns. It's not like I was an orphanage, you know. I was educated by Catholic nuns, and some of them were the nicest people that I've met in my whole life, and others were the most miserable people I've met in my whole life. And it has a lot to do with whether they wanted to be there or not, I'm sure. Although, in the case of my fifth grade teacher, the gout really contributed. Anybody else? All right, here's a question up here.
One thing is, you talked about the three categories of evil, and Maimonides identified three categories of evil, and his last category was the evil that we do to ourselves, and yet I don't remember you mentioning that, and I was wondering if you believed in that kind of evil.
Oh, yeah. I think you can tell from what I've said, I'd rather that the terms evil and good disappear also, because I think that they're confusing terms. I think what we need to talk about is cruelty. We need to talk about these specific things rather than a generalized term, but I'll go back to your thing. Yes, I think we are certainly callous to ourselves. We are certainly cruel to ourselves. We certainly don't see our self-interest very clearly. And we even tell ourselves we shouldn't be self-interested, which is also extremely confusing, because I think more virtue will result from a clear perception of your self-interest than from anything else. Unselfishness, most of the time, is an intelligent form of selfishness. And you do it because you want to be happy. And for those who think that happiness is not the goal, you have to kind of look back and say, okay, people say, no, this is a valley of tears. Our life here is a valley of tears. But the purpose is to go through that valley of tears virtuously so that you get to go to heaven. Now, if heaven was a valley of tears, in addition to here, would anybody want to get to heaven? No. Everybody would say, well, heck, if heaven is a valley of tears too, I'm going to, you know, eat, drink, and be merry here, even though I'm going to suffer for all eternity in heaven, because at least I had fun here. I can remember it. I hope, you know. So I think that this is, again, as Thomas More made arguments like that, other theologians as well, but very few, that happiness you expect in heaven. And if heaven is the goal, then you're still saying happiness is the goal of life. If nirvana wasn't any fun, you wouldn't want to go to nirvana either. If enlightenment was no fun, if going to Brahmaloka was no fun, if going to hell was no fun, you wouldn't want to go there. That's a totally different story, but you know, that's what Mark Twain said. He said, heaven for climate, hell for company. The man who liked free will. I'm gonna, in March, that's my next lecture, I'm going to talk about Mark Twain's funny fight for free will. Any other questions? Our time is up. One last question? No. Good enough. Okay. Thank you very much. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion.